You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane.
This is Free Range, a co-production of KYRS and Range Media. I'm Luke Baumgarten, an editor at Range Media here in Spokane, and I'm joined by my co-host, City Hall reporter Aaron Sellers. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, Luke.
And we're also joined by one of our other colleagues today, Aaron Hedge. How you doing, Aaron?
Good. How are you, Luke?
Doing great. And hello to all of you listening at home or in your car or wherever there are still radios in the world.
Hey, you can stream this too.
You can stream it, KYRS.org. Welcome back to the premiere episode of Free Range, a weekly rundown of important news stories from Spokane and slightly beyond, but this is a local news show. You may have noticed I said welcome back to a premiere episode. How is such a thing possible? Well, because we made the extremely sane decision on Tuesday to make our first ever live broadcast and election night special before this thing had ever even premiered. We preempted Democracy Now! And everything. And I thought we did pretty good our first time out. Aaron, what did you think?
Yeah, besides the raging sinus infection, I think we sounded pretty decent.
We both have, I guess depending on how sexy you think froggy voices are, we're both a little under the weather, but recovering.
Slightly too many cigarettes for Hell Weekend.
In your case, anyways, I definitely do not smoke, ever. There wasn't much left unclear on election night locally, but we are going to be doing an update a little bit later in the show. We're going to start, though, with the fentanyl crisis in Spokane. In a story that just dropped today, the Inlander's Samantha Wolfile offered two statistics that really underscored not just how devastating fentanyl has been in our community, but how rapidly it's risen in prominence. Samantha quoted the stat of, in 2018, one person passed away from fentanyl. Back over a decade ago when I was working at the Inlander, we were hearing about pharmaceutical fentanyl as far back as 2007, 2008. That was bad back then, but really hadn't, you know, there were one max deaths, you know, a year until relatively recently. Contrast that with 2023, when 194 people died in Spokane, a new record, and as Samantha wrote, more than one death every other day. So, but for me, Spokane didn't declare a fentanyl emergency until 2024, Aaron. So one of the things I'm really wondering is, do we think that emergency declaration was a harbinger of an even worse 2024, or just a recognition that things have gotten as bad as they've gotten in 2023? Do we think it's more of the same this year or worse?
No, I think it's already gotten worse. Earlier this year, I was covering the lack of publicly available data on the fentanyl crisis. And I will say that coverage led to better data. Unfortunately, what that data showed is that even in just the first quarter of 2024, we'd had more overdoses, more Narcan usage. And I don't see any reason that that trend would be going down. Mayor Lisa Brown declared a fentanyl state of emergency in the first week of June because year-to-date opioid overdoses were already up 30% from last year. So it's, I think it's gotten significantly worse.
And Sam had a statistic that the CDC estimates that overdose deaths in Washington had increased by 11%. That would suggest maybe we're three times above the average statewide.
I've seen statistics somewhere, and I think Spokane is doing worse than the state as a whole. Yeah. And what's so interesting and unfortunate about these statistics is that the rest of the nation is seeing a downward trend in overdoses. Right. So Washington and Spokane specifically are behind on improving that.
And you, earlier this summer, you did a ride-along with the Behavioral Response Unit. I want to talk about that in a second, but I wanted to kick it over to Hedge for a moment because as I was thinking about this coverage we're going to do today, I was thinking about just all the sort of small ways that things like fentanyl and addiction and homelessness and mental health touch our in ways that we don't necessarily, I don't always think of as being a fentanyl story. You wrote about sort of the forced the forced, how do I put this? The forced baptism of an unhoused man named Zach, by Sean Foyt and Matt Shea, last year. And you spent a lot of time talking to Zach about his journey to, you know, of addiction and stuff. Do you want to, what was that like for you reporting that?
I mean, it was, I think that, it was a window into how people who enjoy, you know, a certain privilege in society are willing to exploit the stories of people who are suffering.
Mm.
That was kind of the bigger thrust of that story for me.
Right.
Basically what happened was this Christian worship pastor named Sean Foyt held a concert here and brought this local homeless man who had stolen his guitar on stage and claimed that he had given his life over to Jesus, and we tracked him down. Me and Ben Tobin, who's a local photographer who does work for us sometimes. And yeah, it was, they invited him up on stage and they said that they saved him, and then they baptized him against his will, is the story that Zach told us. And, they made some attempts. They had made some attempts at trying to, get him into a sober house, the Christian churches that were involved in this concert. And, you know, he kept telling them that he wasn't ready to stop smoking fentanyl. He didn't want to stop. And this guy had lived most of his life on the streets since he was 10. I think he was 32 when we met. So he's been on the streets for more than 2 decades. And it was a really, kind of a devastating portrait of where the crisis has gotten to, where there's this community of people out there that people, you know, feel like they can walk all over. Right. And that's kind of what that story meant to me.
Yeah. I mean, he'd been on the street since he was 10. He was probably not smoking fentanyl at age 10. And that, to me, underscores another thing that we've seen over the last 2 or 3 years in all of our reporting on, you know, the struggles of Spokane's unhoused population, that is the cause of homelessness sometimes mental health, and maybe even frequently, maybe even a majority of the time, existing mental health issues or drug addiction leading to houselessness. Sure. Also, though, plenty of people we've spoken to don't develop their habits or their addictions until they're already on the street. And so that's another pretty brutal example of how that happens.
Yeah. And that was certainly the case for Zach. You know, he didn't go into detail with this with me, but I sensed that he had struggled with, you know, some family issues, and he was out in the streets at a very, very young age. And, I don't know when he started his fentanyl habit. But it's a central part of his life. He doesn't, he doesn't ever depart from it. It's built into his routine. And yeah, he did tell us that, you know, he wasn't using heavy drugs at the time that he left home.
Yeah. And it's also kind of an evidence of what we hear a lot from, people who are more maybe in a supportive housing mindset in terms of how we deal with these sorts of issues as a society. But Zach wasn't, he certainly didn't have a conversion experience. And if he would have, it wouldn't have been enough to get him to stop, smoking. And that kind of ties into the story you did with the behavioral response unit. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about that, Aaron. It's basically a non-police response to, when people are in sort of crisis with addiction.
Yeah. So technically it's a co-response unit, which, means that they're deployed to calls that come into the fire department and also the police department. It's like a tag. When I was riding along with them, they would see that they would get like tagged on to a call.
Right.
So they're not necessarily usually the first people on scene. But they can be if, like, somebody calls in and it's very clear that they're describing an overdose.
Right.
But oftentimes they come to situations where the first responders have gotten there and seen an overdose or seen a mental health crisis, because they also go out to mental health crises as well. And I rode along with them for a day. It is a fire paramedic named Colin McGinty and a licensed mental health counselor and mental health professional from Frontier Behavioral Health named Jordan Ellenwood. And that fire paramedic rotates every 6 months. So I went out with them in July or June. I think I went at the end of June and then rode about it in July. So pretty soon it won't be Colin and it will be somebody else. Which is also interesting. But yeah, they go out to these calls and oftentimes they're dealing with people who are in crisis. A lot of the calls I saw were people who had just been revived from overdoses. So these are people that were on the brink of death and have been brought back. It's an incredibly traumatic moment in their lives.
Right.
And I was really struck by watching them because these are people that might slip through the cracks. The person that I centered my story around was named Gabriel. And when we arrived to the call, paramedics had already been there. They had paramedics from AMR had already talked to Gabriel. I don't remember if the paramedics had Narcan'd Gabriel or if somebody who called it in had given Gabriel Narcan. But either way, this man had been revived. And he originally said that he wanted to go to the hospital and was in the back of the ambulance, but had then sort of changed his mind as we were getting an update from the paramedic and hopped out of the back of the ambulance and took off running. And if you ask the folks in the fire department, they'll say that one of the big points of this unit is to stop what Mayor Brown has called high utilizers of the system from going to the hospital. So that's not to say that, like, if you need the hospital, they're going to tell you you can't go. But for things like overdoses, a lot of times people get taken to the hospital and then that's a low priority call. So they'll sit in the waiting room for hours or for a mental health crisis. And there have been incidents of people getting up and leaving because withdrawals are agonizing. So if you're just sitting there waiting for medication for withdrawals, there's not a lot of incentive to stay.
Yeah.
And
well, if I remember correctly from your story, the reason that the BRU unit, when it was created, it's got its own little suburban that they call Bertha or something.
Bertha. Yeah. Well, funding just got approved for them to get a new Bertha.
Okay. So Bertha was in need of some maintenance when you wrote your story. But the reason that they'll transport folks in Bertha rather than in an ambulance is that ambulances only get reimbursed when they go to an ER. Is that, am I remembering that correctly? Correction.
They don't transport people in Bertha, but they work with the folks at STARS, which is the, oh God, what's that an acronym for? But they have cars that they can call in to people other places that aren't ambulances and that are funded through different mechanisms, because ambulances are incentivized to take people to hospitals instead of to, like, recovery centers or even urgent cares.
Because AMR is a contracted private company that does our ambulance services for us, and they basically get paid when they drop somebody off at an approved place like an ER center. And so there are just even these in our sort of privatized and dispersed, you know, healthcare service sector, it's kind of hard to divert somebody away from a high utilization like an ER through the traditional means. So they had to create this other, you know, basically a workaround, correct?
I mean, yes. And one of the calls I went out on wasn't drug related at all. It was a young woman who had called in, and the responders who showed up were kind of confused what to do with her. She had, she said she just had a bad headache and she hadn't slept and she was like maybe having a mental health crisis, but wasn't flagging necessarily enough flags to say for sure. And she just kept saying she wanted to go somewhere else. And the hospital wasn't a good fit for her because they couldn't identify anything, like any major symptoms, but they couldn't take her anywhere else besides the hospital. So the BRU gets sent out to this, and Ellenwood has this deep conversation with this gal trying to figure out, like, okay, what is actually wrong? What do you actually need? And it comes out that, like, she is having some symptoms, and going to a doctor would be a good fit, but not the hospital. It's not an emergency.
Right, not like the emergency.
So yeah. Ellingwood calls the STARS car, which, again, normally handles overdoses, but asks them if they'd be willing to transport this woman to a nearby urgent care.
And that really is sort of broadly kind of the point, right? We're trying to... even in situations like that, this is a lower cost and more flexible way to sort of get folks whatever we think they need at a time, rather than doing it the more expensive route through an ambulance and a potential trip to the ER.
Right. It's trying to unburden the system so that people who are actually experiencing extreme emergencies can access those services, and also so that, like, you get care immediately. If you go to an urgent care, you're much more likely to get seen quicker than if you go to an emergency room for non-emergency symptoms.
One of the other really brutal and humanizing elements of your story, Aaron, was when Gabriel ends up at the emergency room anyways, because apparently with naloxone, the level of overdose, you might need a second dose of Suboxone, correct? Or...
yeah, so it's complicated, and I don't want to dive necessarily into the weeds, but the BRU can administer Suboxone, which will sort of stop the symptoms of withdrawal from setting in. So Narcan brings you back to life.
Yeah.
Suboxone stops withdrawal symptoms in the simplest sense of the word.
Right.
Or that's the simplest explanation I can give. And so Gabriel, the guy from that I first started talking about, he runs away from the ambulance, right? And the AMR lady is like, all right, well, there he goes. I'm off to another call. But since we're already there, McEntee, the fire paramedic, chases him down and is like, hey, man, like, do you want to talk? Do you want to talk about this? Like, there are other options besides going to the emergency room and going back out under the bridge. And Gabriel ends up telling Colin that it's like his 9th time or his 10th time overdosing. He doesn't want to do it anymore. But as they're having this conversation, he starts to experience withdrawals, which are extremely painful. He's sweating. He's crying.
Writhing around on the ground.
Yeah. Writhing around on the ground, screaming. And he does say, like, I want help. I don't want to do this anymore. So that's kind of the go-ahead for McEntee to get permission to administer Suboxone, because that happens under a medical doctor's license.
Right.
So he calls. He describes the situation. He gets permission to give Suboxone. And at first, Gabriel's symptoms seem to be getting better. Like, it seems to have handled the withdrawals. And Ellingwood gets him in a car that takes him to STARS. And almost as soon as we've packed up and headed back to the fire station, they get tagged to another call, and it's back at the STARS Center where Gabriel had been taken to. And he had his withdrawal symptoms came back and more extreme than the first time. So
they basically had to take him to the emergency room because he needed a level of care that they couldn't provide as the BRU, right?
Sort of. So they come back. Again, this is all so complicated.
And it's really tied to just like the rules and
the
regulations.
The rules and regulations, right. Healthcare. So McEntee gets permission to administer a second dose of Suboxone, and that eases Gabriel's symptoms almost immediately. But at this point, he's had like a breakdown in the STARS Center. He's experienced a crisis there.
Oh, I see.
And STARS asks for, like, their policy is that he has to go get medically cleared at this point. And with Suboxone, if there's... there's a couple things with it that can happen. Either he didn't get enough right off the bat, or he, that's called a protracted withdrawal.
Mm.
Or wait, no, that's a precipitated withdrawal if you don't get enough right off the bat. And a protracted withdrawal is not caused by Suboxone usage, and it's just withdrawal symptoms peak later than expected.
Right.
So he might not have been at his peak when he got Suboxone, and the symptoms just kept worsening, and he needed more.
And it's just such a... I guess everything that I took away from your story was just how complicated and how high-touch these interactions need to be in order to sort of do what is right for the person in the moment, and then also... every person's on their own journey of addiction or recovery. And so the flexibility of the BRU really helps sort of navigate that with the folks they're reaching out to.
Yeah, the goal is to kind of be that last safety net and to catch people in these moments of crisis when they might be willing to accept help before withdrawal set in, before they're high again. Because withdrawals are like, this is the first time I'd seen it in person, and it looked agonizing. And the only answers to that are methadone or Suboxone or some other kind of like medication-assisted treatment. Or you go through withdrawals, which are miserable, and you manage to do that, or you take fentanyl again. But what's interesting about this program, and what Samantha Wolfile covered, is that less than a dozen people have actually taken the team up on that final offer to get on a methadone-assisted treatment or get into treatment. So they do a lot. They direct people to other resources every day, but the goal is to get people into long-term treatment. And I got to see one of those. Gabriel was one of those people. So it was a little bit of a victory.
Awesome. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back.
This is your KYRS live and local calendar for November 4th through the 8th. Monday, open mic with Vanessa Pete and Ben 10 at the Red Room. Monday and Tuesday, open jam at Jackson Street. Tuesday, David Jeter and the All-Star Jam with Jerry Lee Raines at Zola. Wednesday, open mic at the Downtown Spokane Central Library, Malachi Burrow and Jackson Rolkin at Zola, Hippie Death Cult and Kadabra at the Big Dipper, open mic with Derek Hart at the Checkerboard, and open jam at the Red Room. Thursday, Grey Lotus and Lucretia at the Big Dipper, Lazy, Vastive, and Alien Park at Riverside Place, and Terrapin Flyer at the District. Friday, Betsy Rogue and Rosie CQ at Nine Bar and Bistro, Dimitri Matheny and David Larson at Hamilton Studio, Chris Calico at the Red Room, Saffron City, Spicy Ketchup, and Dave Small in the Jaguar Room at the Chameleon, and Scott H. Byram and the Hooten Hollers at the Big Dipper. For an entire hour of local musicians, tune into Sounds of Spokane. Catch Betsy Rogue live in the studio this Sunday night at 8 on KYRS.
Tune in Mondays at 4 p.m. for Solidarity Spokane, the Inland Northwest's local labor hour, hosted by Cat Sabotage, elevating the voices of everyday workers and worker organizations, fighting for your rights in the workplace and fostering community solidarity. Join us here to reclaim control over your own destiny by reclaiming the conditions and products of your labor. That's Mondays at 4 p.m. here on KYRS Thin Air Community Radio. An injury to one is an injury to all.
All right, we're back. We just navigated the computer for the first time. That was great. Story two. There's a story in the Spokesman from Alexander Duggan this week about a long time coming, actually, police use of force change. Aaron, where did you want to talk about that?
I just had some questions about it. They're distancing themselves from, I mean, her headline is Spokane Police Department is distancing from vague use of force techniques. Here's what that means. And it's moving away from the term exceptional techniques. And I was hoping you could tell me more about what exactly exceptional techniques are or what that term means.
I think the whole point of the exceptional techniques and the reason that people have been really pushing to get those, they've been pushing through the ombudsman's office, and this goes all the way back to, you know, almost a decade ago when Spokane voted to change its city charter to give the ombudsman actual authority to have like a little bit more teeth around use of force and potential, you know, abuse of power by police and police officers. The exceptional techniques was sort of like to some people, intentionally vague catch-all term at the end of like, here's how you're allowed to use force, except if things get really bad, then you can use exceptional techniques. That's not a quote, that's just a paraphrase. And so the critics of that sort of vague language said that led to a lot of, it just basically can be, if not properly controlled, carte blanche for officers to say, oh, I thought I was, you know, I feared for my life, I decided to take these exceptional techniques, which again have no definition. There's no like, here are the kinds of exceptional techniques you can use, here are the kinds you can't. And so there was just so much vagueness built into it that reform advocates were saying this is basically just carte blanche to do whatever you want.
I saw the example that Duggan cited was a case where a Spokane police officer kicked a man who was already handcuffed in the groin and claimed that it was necessary, and paraphrase here, but because the suspect was large and angry and still resisting, but he was handcuffed already.
Yeah.
And so the Duggan wrote that the department's investigative panel, made up of supervisors, did not believe that the strike violated the department's policy, mostly because the policy was unclear, but still the officer was fired. So I feel like that's a good example of kind of this language is vague, and he technically didn't maybe violate the policy because the policy was too vague to hold him to, but he still did something wrong and they acknowledged that.
Yeah. I mean, this is he may or may not have been a large individual, but he was handcuffed. And that's part of also this whole exceptional techniques thing is there's this idea in law enforcement. And this is the stated policy of the Spokane Police Department that de-escalation is like, you're supposed to always be trying to de-escalate conflict. And Duggan quoted longtime sort of just a general purpose lawyer, but Jeffrey Finer, who's done a lot of work around excessive force cases, saying something to the effect, let me find it here, use of force, even if you feel like it's you need it to get the upper hand in a fight, can also sometimes have unintended consequences around de-escalation, right? So if somebody does come after you, you might need to use force to get the upper hand, but that also might hamper efforts to de-escalate. And so people are pretty roundly saying that this is a good change to the policy sheet, but also part of the story was that this took 5 years and a new police chief to make it happen, and probably also a change in leadership at the police guild, which is the union that represents officers. So I don't think it made it into the story, but a tweet after the fact, Alexandra quoted Dave Duncan, who's the president of the department's police guild, saying he welcomes the decision as long as it, quote, makes things better, which, again, I am not a, you know, everyday cops reporter, but that language feels a lot more conciliatory and a lot more compromising than previous guild reps.
Yeah, you've wrote about, and I'm not a cops reporter, I don't cover the police department very often, but I know when I was looking at Range and when I was thinking about applying for this job, some of the coverage that you specifically were writing at the time was about police use of force in Spokane. And I guess I was curious, what's some of the history or the lead up to this decision that makes this significant?
Well, I mean, the big thing in my memory as a increasingly old millennial was the death of Otto Zemm at the hands of Carl Thompson, which was Otto Zemm was a person who had developmental disabilities who came in to a sort of like a 7-Eleven to buy some soda and a candy bar and ended up dead at the hands of Thompson. That Thompson was eventually convicted liable for Zem's murder, but it took a decade. It took a really, really long time. And so that was the moment. That was one of the catalysts that led to the change in charter to maybe, I would need to check this, but maybe even create the ombudsman's office in the first place. But it certainly also then led to the change in the city charter to give the office of the police ombudsman more power than they actually have, than they had at the time. But one of the things that's hampered that, and this is one of the sources of frustration for people who say, and to be clear, we just went through an election where I think, you know, the top, the thing that passed most overwhelmingly passed with around 60-65% of the vote, the charter change to add, you know, additional enforcement powers to the police ombudsman passed with over 70% of the vote. I've never seen a more lopsided election result in my time as an adult and as a journalist. It only lost in like one precinct. It was in Beacon Hill, was the only place in anywhere in Spokane where it didn't pass. And so it's been something that's not just, you know, liberals, not just, you know, reform advocates are fighting for. It was something that at the time the people of Spokane overwhelmingly wanted. And it's actually applying those teeth, though. You can put it in the city charter, but it all comes down to how the contract that the city does with the cops every few years. And so that's been historically the final hurdle to actually getting a police ombudsman with real powers.
Yeah.
is the contract itself.
I was at a city council meeting a couple weeks ago where Bart Logue, the ombuds, was presenting stats and from the last year to the council. And one of his big frustrations was a lack of real independence in a couple of key areas. And he was kind of imploring this council and this mayor. And he specifically cited that 70% statistic of like, hey, everyone wants this. You need to give us more independence. And one of the things he specifically talked about was the ability to write his own reports. And to like publicize his own reports from that office. And there was one other thing that gets a little weedy and complicated, and I don't know if I remember all of the details of it, so I don't want to talk about it specifically, but something about like appointing people to his office or appointing staff has to get approval from folks in the police department.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact details there, but the upshot is, the broad upshot is that if you can't be an independent body, if the people who work in the body, the approval mechanism goes through the people that you have oversight over, right? So it would be equivalent of like, it's my job to make sure you aren't swearing on air right now, Aaron. But the person, so if I were the Aaron Sellers swearing ombudsman, it would be my job to make sure you didn't swear, but you would have choice over who I am, right? So you might want to choose somebody who would let you be a little more lenient with your swearing on the air. So that's, you can see how that could, at least in the minds of reform advocates, would be a conflict of interest, and for Logue, something that he believes really hampers his ability to do his job.
Right. So when does this new policy change go into effect? Do you know?
That's a really good question. It's a little, I mean, so much about this stuff is vague, and the story doesn't go into a ton of detail. And I'm going to skim real quick just to make sure I didn't accidentally miss it somewhere. But yeah, I would sort of assume that it's going to go into effect relatively immediately, because again, it's a police procedure. So it's not something that has to be voted on. It's not something that has to go through the legislative process. It's something that the and frankly, I think it's something that folks were critical of Chief Meidel for, that he did have the power to change this policy and chose not to. And so it took the new chief, Hall, coming in and, you know, under a new mayor. And I think it's whenever there's a succession of leadership, it's an opportunity to sort of reset the dynamics that are happening. We heard sort of anecdotally, and this was reported, but not necessarily on the record, that Meidel had sort of struggled to get the backing of the cops under his beat. And so he was a leader he was obviously the chief of police, but he didn't always have the same control over the folks that worked at the police that a stronger leader might have. And so there's a sense that with Hall coming in, he was brought in explicitly to be more of a reformer, and that's with the progressive city council and Mayor Brown as a, you know, relatively progressive mayor. That was sort of the task that he was given when he was hired, and so it's sort of his job now to actually make this stuff happen.
Yeah, Hall's hire is interesting. I know that the process has been touted as one of the best examples of engagement, citizen engagement in a process. There was like a committee of like 20 people made up of key individuals in the mayor's office, from city council, in community orgs, that made these decisions. And Hall's quotes about this tend to indicate to me, at least, that he's thinking of himself as somebody who both has to get the people on his side and get his officers on his side. He told Duggan that the elimination doesn't, of these words and the policy, doesn't just protect citizens, but, quote, protects officers if they know they have to justify and clearly define their actions. So I think he's thinking of this also as a policy that makes it clear when officers can and can't be punished, when they have and haven't broken use of force rules.
Right. I mean, that sort of vagueness would only benefit you if you had messed up and were trying to do something, you know, trying to sort of justify your actions after the fact, I would think. And you and I have actually, you know, chatted with officers from SPD that have said, like, they actually want clarity because they don't accidentally want to, like, they want to know exactly what they're allowed to do and not do so that then they can stay within the use of force requirements. And so this removing vague language like that will help.
Right. I'm tentatively optimistic about how this will work. Do you have anything that you are looking forward to in the coming year around this, or like any indicators that people should watch around Kevin Hall's new position?
No, but it makes me think as we get a little bit more time now that the elections are done and we're going into 2025, we should spend some time with Bart Logan in his office and sort of, I think someone like him is going to be, because he's an appointed position, so he's not an elected official, he's not a cop, and he has a lot of the historical memory, and he's been sort of struggling in these, you know, the constraints. He's been pretty vocal about how constrained he feels. So I think where the rubber is going to meet the road is whether or not he actually feels more empowered to do the sort of investigations he wants to do.
I'm interested in tracking fatal police shootings, because before Hall took over as the police chief in 2024, there had been more shootings in like the first 6 months than there had been in the entirety of last year.
And we know that by per capita, Spokane, the
second deadliest
per capita in the nation, and that fluctuates, but we've been in the top five for a really long time, and certainly in the top 10 for a really long time. And it's per capita, so it's sort of based on how big of a city you are. So we don't have as many murders as St. Louis, but for a city our size, we have, you know, we're up there. And so it's hard to sort of compare. It's sort of an apples to oranges comparison in some ways, except that for a city with as many police involved shootings as we have, our violent crime rates are way, way lower, even per capita, than a lot of the other places that are high up the list. And so that especially itself has been a thing that advocates for reform pointed out, that it's like violent crime rates are not a perfect indicator of if an individual police officer or a group of police officers feels like they're fearing for their life in that moment. But just in the aggregate, we have less violent crime, so we should have fewer fatal shootings theoretically.
And yet
we do. And so, and you know, pretty famously, or I would say infamously, Police Chief Meidel sort of did a whole YouTube video about the math around the mapping police violence statistics that just, I'm a failed math major. And so it was like,
failed math major, successful philosophy major.
Exactly. But it's like it was just clear that he didn't understand what per capita meant and was trying to sort of justify the use of force based on that. And that really rubbed a lot of folks the wrong way, who are like, you're trying to argue against a technicality when we're saying that, you know, a lot of folks are dying and maybe shouldn't be given how much violent crime we have in Spokane. And so it'll be interesting to see from a perspective of like Logue or whoever, if Hall comes to that violence with a different with a different sort of intentionality around lessening the amount of officer involved shootings we have in Spokane.
Definitely. So if you want to learn more about any of the issues we've talked about today, from the fentanyl crisis to use of force and this policy change at SPD, if you want to read any of the stories we've referenced, you can check out our show page on kyrs.org/show/free-range, where we have all of these stories linked.
And we will be right back. We're going to do one more quick break, and we will be back with an election update momentarily.
KYRS Thin Air Community Radio provides our region with information that might be omitted, overlooked, or even censored by mainstream media. Your radio station is powered by the communities they serve and our radio programs as rich and diverse as the Spokane community itself. Please make a pledge today by texting Give KYRS to the number 44321. Your support ensures that KYRS can continue to celebrate the rich diversity of our community.
Join me, Captain Maeve, as we head out and about, featuring LGBTQ folk, friends, allies, and all who make Spokane a better place through inclusion, creativity, truth, and beauty. Local stories, conversations, and creations with universal appeal. Out and about every Tuesday at 4 p.m. on KYRS.
KYRS is grateful for the many listeners who have donated their vehicles to us. You can join them by donating your unwanted car, truck, minivan, motorcycle, and more. Vehicles are picked up free of charge, sold, and the proceeds help KYRS bring you the programs you know and love. It's easy to donate your vehicle, and it's tax deductible. Just call our toll-free line to arrange a free pickup. 855-KYRS-CAR. That's 855-597-7227. Thank you.
And we're back with an election update. Like I said, we didn't have a ton of stuff that was hanging out at the end of Tuesday night, locally anyways. And we don't have a ton of additional knowledge now. Only one additional count has been done. We know that there were about 30,000 votes outstanding, but that probably at the end of Tuesday night, but that didn't account stuff that was probably dropped off right at the end. Like, I think every person from the range team who was coming up to do that election night show dropped off at least one ballot. So there were plenty of those out there. We now know, as of the count that happened at 5 p.m., these counts happen at 5 p.m. every day in the county, or every day post-election until all the counts are, until all the counting is done. So we should be expecting another one around 5 p.m. today.
There was 40,000 votes outstanding after the count yesterday.
Right. And so let's do a quick little update on all those things. What sort of order do we want to take here?
Aaron? Yeah, so let's look at local taxes first. We all love taxes. Measure one, which was the renewal of a countywide sales tax to fund the county's juvenile criminal justice system, has been in place for about 30 years, and voters were deciding whether or not to approve that tax to continue until December of 2035, and that has pretty thoroughly, I think it's fair to say that has passed. I think we can make
for
a call
sure.
on
it's
that
It's about
now.
Two-thirds, yeah.
About 65.83% of voters voted to pass that. And the other slightly more controversial tax, honestly, I thought that this was going to be a much closer race,
yep.
Was Proposition 1, which was a citywide tax in Spokane.
And this was a new tax for public safety.
New tax, which
Or community
was
safety, they called it.
Community safety, yeah. 0.1%. So that's about $1 for every $1,000 that you spend. And that asked voters whether or not they wanted to fund that enhanced community safety language, which is a little bit vague. City plans have said that they're going to spend that money on police, fire, Office of the Ombuds, and community courts. But again, none of that language is in the ballot. So the city can commit to that from the mayor's office and commit to that from the city council level. But that doesn't mean that a future mayor or council won't change that language.
Yeah.
Because you're just voting on what's on your ballot. And that is sitting at 57.79% of the votes. So also pretty fair to say that this tax has passed, which I would call a victory for Mayor Lisa Brown.
Yeah, especially given that we've both locally and nationally just lived through an election where economic concerns trumped a lot of other concerns for a lot of folks. And so, yeah, I think a lot of people thought that this was not going to pass, or if it did, it would be more of a squeaker than it was.
Yeah, but I think it is fair to say that people are willing to take a hit to their wallets if they think that it will equal public safety. The city's got a tight budget right now. Brown's new biannual budget proposal is supposed to create a balanced budget for the next 2 years. When she came in, first estimates thought we were at about a $50 million budget deficit because of our use of one-time funds. Brown will give a more conservative estimate of a $25 million budget deficit.
Mm-hmm.
And her plan is to cut that to zero by the next 2 years. But that is going to, I guess, And I mean, to be clear, when she first proposed a tax, it was a property tax right. that she pitched as filling some of that budget deficit. That faced pretty immediate community pushback, and she switched to a more regressive sales tax. This gets passed on to poorer people quicker, but it is a much smaller amount of money. It's going to generate between $6 and $7 million every year.
Yeah. Do you remember what the property tax would have generated?
I do not, but it was much higher than this. And after the budget proposal, her office started saying that this is actually not going to fill this. We're not counting this money as filling gaps. We're counting this money as new investments.
Right.
That's what they're saying, at least.
So they're basically trying to balance the budget separate from this tax and using this tax to do new community safety initiatives.
That's the idea. Anyways, we will see how that goes.
All right, we got about 10 minutes left in the show, so we might have to speed run through some of these. The closest, and I would say most consequential race from Tuesday night is still too close to call. It's the county commission race between incumbent Al French, who's a longtime Republican in the 5th District. It's 5th District, which is kind of southwest of Spokane in the county, and Molly Marshall. There were about a little under 900 votes separating them on Tuesday night, and now there's a little more than 900 votes separating them.
It's over 1,000 now.
It's over 1,000 now, but there again, there's still 40,000 votes countywide to count.
It's hard to say how many of those are from District 5.
Right. And though, that's roughly 15% of the total votes cast. So if there were to be that's why it's too close to call still, because that's some percentage of 40,000, and it's a tight enough race that, you know, theoretically there could be a move in the race if all the late votes broke for Marshall. But
right
now French is ahead, and this would be his closest margin of victory if he were to pull it off.
Hedge, you were at Marshall's party last night, Tuesday night. Oh, gosh, time. What was the vibe at Molly Marshall's election party?
The vibe was, it was more, I think they were watching the numbers as best they could, and it struck me as more of kind of like a gratitude for the movement vibe. There's been some pretty heavy organizing among people who live in rural areas out in the West Plains between Spokane and Airway Heights, who are dealing with forever chemicals contamination in their drinking water that many people kind of pin some of the blame on the incumbent Al French. And that was a big issue in the election. And that was the composure of the folks who showed up to that event.
You know, one of the questions I've seen a lot on like Reddit or other places where folks in Spokane congregate is, why does French catch the blame for that when other members of the Spokane Airport Board who are sitting on municipal governments do not? What's your take on that as somebody who's been kind of reporting this out for the last 8 months?
Yeah, so there's a number of other people on that board who are part of local governments, including a city representative and some at-large members who also knew about the contamination at the same time that Al French did, or they should have known. I did speak with some folks on the board who said that they didn't notice it, which seemed probably doesn't land well with West Plains residents.
Right.
But I think there's a big focus on Al French for, and this is, you know, just kind of from what I've seen as a reporter who's written a lot about this. Al French is, by trade, he's an architect and a developer, and he's always ran his campaigns as that, as a person who takes development very seriously. And he's scored some really big victories for what people I'm sure many perceive as big victories for jobs on the West Plains, including the big Amazon fulfillment center out there. He helped foster a partnership between the Air Force and the Sheriff's Office to get a big fancy new training facility for the Spokane County Sheriff out on the West Plains. And I think that's really appealing to people. And it's, you know, that's one of the, it's also one of the advantages that he has in incumbency. So I think that a lot of people see Al French as kind of the face of environmental issues out there.
Well, I think more than the face, I mean, I think the most compelling argument I've heard is that French is such a power broker at the county, mm-hmm. and the county is so has so much control and power. We talked about this on Tuesday, so much power and control over so many different kinds of boards. And so at different points, French was is still on the board of the airport and was at the on the board when this contamination was discovered. Mm-hmm. He's also been really, really influential in our public health board and with S3R3, which is a separate board that handles the development of the area around the airport. And so that's three different boards he's had a lot of power over in his capacity as probably the most powerful commissioner. And those are at odds. Like the idea of like public, like a well contamination is the definition of a public health crisis. And people who are critical of his handling of, and some would say the cover up of the contamination, because this was discovered in 2017, it was a conflict of interest for him to be both on a development board and an airport board and a public health board at the same time. So there were other people that knew about this contamination, but nobody had sort of the oversight over all of these different things or was a part of all these different boards at the time that that happened.
And yeah, that's exactly right. And he built a lot of support for the projects that he brought to the West Plains as a representative of these boards.
Right.
So it was, you know, it was his work for those boards that helped bring, like he was in a position to bring those things into the community. And I think that that's kind of like why there's a big focus on Al French. It's also a race that I think people felt like they could change. It used to be like the Spokane County Board of Commissioners used to be a 3-person board, but because of changes in state law, they created 2 other seats.
And those 3 people were elected countywide, which meant mm-hmm. that it almost always went Republican, where now it's broken up into districts. So there are 2 districts that tend to go Dem, 2 districts that tend to go Republican, and Al French's district is considered sort of the swing district because it's got the most fluctuation there. I don't mean to cut you off, Hedge.
No
We've
worries.
Got to run down the list of other election
we
results.
We got 3 minutes. We're not going to get to all of them.
We got 3 minutes.
But probably the big, we want to do the initiatives real quick. Those are the statewide initiatives. Those are the big ones.
Sure. You do the statewide initiatives. And then I want to come back to Michael Baumgartner versus Carmela Conroy.
Sure.
Because I do think some interesting things to discuss
so
there.
So the 4 big ballot initiatives that would have repealed various kinds of taxes or bans or the cap and trade, 3 of the 4 of them failed, meaning we will... we still have a Climate Control Commitment Act. That one has failed. So there's still will be the state's commitment to cap and trade programs and reducing carbon emissions. It seems all but likely that the Washington CARES Act, which is a piece of legislation that created a tax to fund a public long-term care insurance program, that is also going to fail. So it looks like we're still going to have a long-term care insurance program at the state.
And that wouldn't have killed the care insurance, but it would have let workers opt out of paying in.
Which would have
and
effectively
killed it. And so there was like a fear that people would opt out and it would create a waterfall where all of a sudden there's not actually enough money in that tax pool to pay for things. So effectively killing it.
As with most forms of insurance, you need healthy people to pay for sick people. And so the idea is that if you let young people opt out, then there won't be enough money in the system for older folks to actually get the care they need. 2109, which is the big one that I wrote a lot about, the capital gains tax, which was a tax only paid by like less than 3,500 people in Washington, but still raised about $1 billion in its first year. The repeal effort on that has also failed. And then the one that's likely to succeed was the ban on natural gas bans, which was sort of the big culture war issue, I would say, or one of them of this election.
Right. Okay, two other races. Washington State Senate District 4 was Leonard Christian versus Miguel Valencia. And Christian emerged from a crowded Republican primary field, won a pretty decisive 64% of the vote to defeat the more progressive Valencia. Those numbers could change a little bit in the coming days, but I think it is very fair to say Christian won that one. Washington State Representative for District 3, Position 1, was Democrat Natasha Hill versus Republican Tony Kipi, and they were vying to fill a seat left vacant by incumbent Marcus Riccielli, who moved over to run for a state senator position. And in their primary race, their primary opponent, Ben Stuckert, who was a Democrat, won almost a third of the votes. It was an extremely close primary, which left folks wondering if his voters would choose the other Democrat in the race, Hill, or gravitate towards Kipi. Last night's election results made the answer pretty clear. Kipi picked up a few percentage points, but Hill held a very definitive lead of 59.24% of votes in the district. Hill says that makes her the first Black woman and person of color to represent Eastern Washington in this seat. I haven't had time to fact check that yet, but it seems pretty likely that that's accurate.
That's actually all we have time for, because we are at 55. We got to go. But we will be right back here next week on Thursday.
Free Range is a weekly news and public affairs program presented by Range Media and produced by Range Media and KYRS Community Radio.
This is KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.
I'm Erin. That's Luke. See you later.